because I really value the time of the individual that's sharing it with us tonight. And just real briefly to introduce him, and more will, I'm sure, reveal itself as the call goes on. But some years ago, I was, and I don't know whether I read the story first in Chicken Soup, because I know his story was in the first Chicken Soup, or whether I read it in Reader's Digest or National Geographic or Life or Look or any of the other places that he's been written about. The LA Times called him the modern day Indiana Jones. And, you know, I read the story of this guy who's got to be one of the all time adventurers. And I read a list of things that he had set out to do with his life. And not only did he reach most of those things, but many other things along the way. And it came at a time in my life when I need a lot of hope and a lot of encouragement and a lot of inspiration. And he gave that to me and encouraged me by his example. He didn't know who I was. I was reading a story about his life, and his life encouraged me to go out and you know, to write a list of my own. Nothing at all like his list, very modest by comparison, but it was special to me. And because of that list that I created as a result of the person I'm going to introduce you to, my life has taken a phenomenal turn. And you know, tonight I'm calling, looking out over a balcony on the Adriatic Sea, John. And I got to tell you, buddy, I appreciate so much the inspiration that you've meant in my life, because in many ways, the fact that I'm here tonight is directly related to the inspiration, the encouragement that you gave me by your own life and by your example. And so I want to introduce you guys to somebody who's very special in my life. I consider him to be, as do most every other expert in the world's number one goal achiever. And I know he's very modest and would probably not prefer that title, but no one else comes even close.
How do you
know that? So if you would, from La Cañada, California, if you'd welcome John Goddard. John, it's really a pleasure to have you with us tonight.
Yeah, it's wonderful being with you all.
John, you know, you and I have had several discussions about this, and, you know, we spent a day together in Dallas a couple of months ago, and I asked you the question, you know, why at a time when most people are caught up in, you know, being a teenager and doing goofy kind of things, and, you know, certainly very, very many teenagers are not as productive as they should be. And you, at the age of 15, sat down and wrote a list of 127 things that you wanted to do with your life that were extremely significant. What was the motivation behind that?
Curiosity and a desire to utilize any time and talent allotted to me. Curious about everything in the world and its peoples and the wonders of nature and all. But I grew up not far from the ocean in Southern California, and the ocean was my great teacher and a tough taskmaster. But just as with you, Vic, I became a bibliophile, a lover of books and reading at an early age, from about the time I was in the fifth grade at 10 years of age. And during the intervening 5 years, by the time I got to be a freshman at Los Angeles High School, my mind was just filled with ambitious things to do and see. It wasn't enough to read about the Great Wall of China, or the Taj Mahal, or the Great Angel Falls in Venezuela. I had to see these things. You know, I was so filled with a feeling of inadequacy. I mean, I was a 50-year-old kid. What had I ever done in life? I was a pretty good surfer and diver and rock climber, but those were just, in a way, superficial to what I really wanted to do. And my folks told me that they were surprised one day to hear me answer a question typical of adults with kids. What do you want to be when you grow up, John? And that was from my Uncle Cecil. And they were amazed to hear me say, explorer. And I don't remember that. But somehow I got it in my mind that I wanted to have a career in nature. And I'd read about some of the great explorers of Africa and Asia and South America. And I thought, what a neat career that would be for a kid who loved wildlife and loved to be away from cities and out in nature. And so that was kind of my motivation to do something with my life and fill in the gaps and, you know, save money, do research, prepare, and then go out and do the things. Because what every goal I wrote down, I visualized doing it, just as you do, Vic. You do a lot of that. And that sets the stage. When you write the goal down, that's a commitment. And as you picture yourself achieving it, that's the next stage. And the next stage is persistence. Most people give up too easily.
All right. Well, you know, John, what I'd like to do, and you and I have talked about this particular story, is the Kagera River story that you shared with me the last time I was with you. And I just kind of want to set the stage with everyone who's on the call tonight. You know, John, at the age of 15, wrote 127 things on a legal pad, and those things were not small by any means. If you look at the list that he created, and you look at some of the things that he's accomplished, he's been to the top of most every major mountain in the world. He's been down every major river. He has dove the reefs of Australia, Florida, of course. You know, wherever there's a reef, I'm sure John's been on, and he's been, you know, to all the great places of history. He's been to the Great Wall of China. He's retraced Marco Polo's steps. He taught himself a number of languages. He's read the Bible from cover to cover, and I could go on and on and on. Now, he was sharing the phenomenally interesting story about how he came to fly a jet fighter as a civilian, and he still holds airspeed records. He's just done some incredibly remarkable things, but his number one goal in life as a 15-year-old was to go down the Nile River, and he saved his money. He went and borrowed some money, and he financed an expedition. And this is so important to hear him describe this, because it really is about claiming your power now, and that's what this call is all about, and that's what our event in October is all about. But there's so many times when we adopt a big goal and we've got something in our heart to do and we have a passion to do it, and we go out and get started right away, and the first thing is life slaps us in the face. And that is exactly what happened to John at a pretty young age. And here he is going after his number one goal to be the first person ever to traverse the entire length of the Nile River. So, John, if you'd tell us, going after, give us a little background on you and your number one goal and what happened on day one of your number one goal.
Well, that's a very pithy question. But, you know, as I did research and studied about the challenges to explorers, again and again, I came upon the Nile River as the most impactful, magnificent feature of Earth, particularly as in terms of history and commerce and development. And the fact that no one had ever explored it source to mouth, I couldn't think of a greater challenge. But typical of every time I wanted to do something unusual, I had a chorus of naysayers. Oh, Goddard, you can't possibly do that. No one's ever done it before, and the same difficulties, dangers, and hardships that turned explorers of the past back will face you, so give it up. And I heard that so much, even from the time I was a young boy and doing rock climbing and diving, you know, and bringing up things for Sunday dinner from the ocean floor. I had adults just try to throw cold water on my hopes and dreams. So I became impervious to that. And I grew up with the idea that the impossible is an invitation to do something really challenging and worthwhile. But the Nile became a passion of mine, because I realized it created Egypt. And for 6,000 years, Egypt influenced human events to a point that if the Nile River had never existed, there would never have been an Egypt. The course of history would have been drastically changed. Because the Nile had an annual flood beginning in the summer, because it took so long for the silt, the fertilizing silt and organic material coming down the Blue Nile from Ethiopia to reach Egypt. And as it flooded, it distributed this fertilizing, rich loam over the desert sand. If you dig down enough, you'll come to sand in Egypt. And it's just amazing to think that Egypt truly is the gift of the Nile, as Herodotus, the great Greek explorer, philosopher, writer, expressed. And there are now all those millions of people living on Nile mud. And 6,000 years ago, nomadic tribes came to the Nile. They saw how the banks were lush with growth, and they put a few seeds in the ground. They started growing things. That expanded to crops. That expanded to architecture and law, religion, art, language. All the ramifications of modern civilization can be traced to Egypt and its impact on all those things in the development of world cultures and nations. And the fact that only 1/4 of the Nile is Egypt, that 3/4 is really wilderness. And my love of being out in wilderness and getting a connection with birds and animals and reptiles and everything and feeling part of it, feeling a relationship with all those things, I thought, my word, this is a dream trip. But originally, I was a member of the French Explorer Society at the time, and one of the members heard of my dream of doing the Nile, and it was his dream too, Jean Laporte. We called him Jean because I'm John also. And we started corresponding, and that led to 3 other French explorers wanting to join us until they started doing research, started writing to authorities along the Nile in Uganda, Sudan, and Egypt, and they were convinced that there would be so many difficulties and hardships and real threats to our lives that they gave, 3 of them gave it up. But as with only months ago...
I didn't know that part of the story. So, because you told me about the 2 that went down it with you, but I didn't realize that you had communicated with some others that shared the same dream and the same goal and never paddled the first paddle.
That's right. They really wanted to go, but authorities convinced them that the Nile dangers were unchanged from even thousands of years ago. They talked about the dangerous hippo and crocodiles, the raging rapids, the sandstorms, the starvation, 125-degree heat, hostile people along the banks. And we experienced all those things. But, Vic, just as you have found, when you're engaged in something with a goal in your mind, you remove one obstacle after another and make the goal. And in life, we always have things that discourage us and set us back. We have bad days. We have frustrations and setbacks and disappointments. But if you keep that goal in mind, if you persist and absolutely have that enthusiastic dedication to achieving the goal, it's astounding what you can do. You know, we discussed one time when you asked me about health and everything. I had pneumonia to a point I nearly died a couple of times by the time I was about 5. At 3, the doctors didn't think I'd make it at all. But from 5 on, I unfortunately had the liability of kind of a scrawny body. And my lungs were scarred. And it didn't look like I'd be very athletic or be able to do much. But as you and I have found, when people have a real disability to overcome in working on it and getting into action, which is so invigorating, your body develops strength and ability in small increments. And it's so gratifying to see yourself expand and grow and make yourself capable of doing all kinds of seemingly impossible things in your original form.
Absolutely. Well, I got you off the track a little bit, but if you would tell us the story about Kagera and now that you've got some other explorers who are interested in doing it with you, and some of them who have quit before you even got started, and you've borrowed the money, and you've kind of staked your reputation, and everybody you've heard the naysayers, and you've persisted despite the naysayers, but now you're on your very first day of the biggest goal of your life, and what happens to you?
Well, it was ironic that the first day nearly was our last. All 3 of us were nearly killed. I did a lot of research on the hydrography and hydrology of the Nile Basin. And I determined that the main feeder to Lake Victoria, which is the head reservoir of the Nile, most people just think, well, that's the source of the Nile. But I tried to go beyond that, what feeds Lake Victoria, and out of 14 streams, the Kagera was the main one. Even Africans have called it the mother of the Nile. But with two wonderful fellow explorers, Gene and the one we recruited with only a month ago, Andre, we set off in three kayaks to go down an unknown river that had never been explored, but we did hike along the banks for several miles to get an idea of what we were up against, and then we pushed off, and it turned out it had about a 15-knot current, which is tremendously fast. This brown flood of water, very narrow, bordered by emerald green papyrus, and then we started encountering hippo, the most dangerous animal of Africa. Last year, 206 Africans died of hippo charges, more than all the combined big game animal attacks. And I won't go into too many details, but I filmed the push off of my two companions, and then I ran and jumped in my kayak and pushed off. And as I was catching up with them, a hippo surfaced just behind me, and I didn't know how fast they could move in water, and I just sort of speeded up a little, and suddenly he was splashing water on me, which accelerated my efforts considerably. And then I took the lead, as I did through the whole expedition, but ahead, it looked like the river had disappeared, because all I could see was green vegetation in front of me. As I got closer, I realized this was created by two small islands overgrown, and I knew we would all jam up there if all three of us tried to go through the narrow gap between the islands. And I waved my buddies to the right. I crashed into the vegetation and vines and interlacing branches and limbs and everything. I crashed into that opening, think I could have enough momentum to get through, but I didn't. I tipped over. Well, actually, my shotgun came shooting out. It was between the baggage in front of me, and it struck me right in the forehead, stunning me. And before I could grab it, it went overboard. And then the kayak turned upside down, throwing me in the water, which just beyond the islands was ferocious. And I came within seconds of drowning there. And that was the first day of the expedition. Andre smashed his kayak on a big boulder and trying to avoid a hippo at the right turn where the river made a diversion, a little detour before joining the main current. Gene shot forward. He had had 15 years of kayaking experience in the rivers of Europe, and he was very skilled. When he saw Andre smash up, then he was able to get past him and continue. And that was the first day. One smashed kayak, two men half dead, and Gene feeling very lugubrious.
Well, I know you said that, you know, you guys hauled yourself up on shore and you dried out and, you know, recuperated and, you know, you surveyed the damage and it looked like, in fact, I think you were even told that you needed to cancel the expedition at that point. Is that right?
Well, the district commissioner said he didn't know of anyone who'd ever been down the Kagera, so he couldn't give us any information. And he, as so many times, the government authority said, John, if you come a cropper, if you are in dangerous situation, don't expect to be rescued. We don't have the personnel or the helicopters or the facilities to do that. So you're on your own. And there we were in not really unexplored totally, but unmapped, uninhabited Africa with the kayaks in bad shape. And I have to tell you, Gene and Andre were evolving a plan that included us ordering new parts for the smash kayak and then getting 500 miles downstream to Juba, the main little town and village in the southern Sudan, which would cut out some of the most dramatically beautiful, fascinating, and colorful sections of the Nile. And I fought for continuing the expedition and just working things out ordering the new port, but in the meantime, traveling downstream with a native dugout called a Matumbi and two Africans helping paddle that, and then we would take turns in the kayaks. So that's how we made it to Juba.
Yeah, and so the great news of the story, folks, I just want to point out to you that the valuable lessons, if you know, that if they're not obvious and apparent as we go along here tonight, because I found this story had so many incredible lessons, was this happens so many times that when we've got something big on our heart and we go out there and we get hit in the face and it looks like we got to stop, it looks like that's what it means, but that's not what it means. And John didn't. But there's even more to this story, which I found really fascinating, because this also happens a lot in the goals process, is that what appears to be disaster and what appears to just totally gut our plan and end our trek turns out to be a big blessing, because it really takes us in a better direction and in a different direction. So, John, what's the rest of the story, so to speak, that what happened that day that almost took your life, in fact, did save your life, because what was just around the corner from you?
That's a good point. You know, if we had not come a cropper right there at that little dangerous situation, if we'd continued on downstream, all three of us would have died, because camouflage by trailing lianas, these great vines hanging down from the branches of giant trees on both banks, they screened a murderous cataract that was so full of rocks, with the current sweeping through so fast, that all three kayaks would have been broken up. We would have been in that water with dense papyrus preventing us from making a normal landing, and we would have drowned. There's no question. So it was a blessing in disguise, and it also prepared us for anticipating our reaction patterns in similar situations downstream, so that we were more cautious, we were more alert, and when we ran 33 rapids farther downstream in the Sudan, the northern Sudan, we were prepared for any exigency, any complication. So we were armed with knowledge and with caution and the stick-to-itiveness, knowing that somehow we could get through, no matter what the odds.
Right. Well, I think if I'm remembering correctly, it took you 10 months from the time you started until the time you finished. Is that
10
accurate?
Months. We were actually 9 months paddling and then a month on safari in Kenya and Uganda. And Beirut.
So in that 9 months, how would you compare the beginning point, that disaster, so to speak, in terms of the entire 9 months? Was that as bad as it got, or was that the worst of it, or did it get worse somewhere along the way? How did that stack up as it related to the whole adventure?
Well, in a sense, that was the most hazardous and most endangering to our lives, but Vic, we had 7 hippo charges, any one of which could have been fatal. We did capsize in rapids farther downstream. We were nearly buried alive in a sandstorm in the Sudan. We were attacked by 30 Egyptian river pirates, and I was alone at the time. You see, every morning I'd set off at dawn to set a pace. And because our metabolisms were different, we reacted slowly or fast to different things. So by noon, Andre would be maybe a mile or two behind, maybe Gene, going slower and savoring things, would be 5 miles behind. So by dusk, I would land on either shore, finding a good campsite. I would build a fire as a beacon for the men to shoot for, and then we would have a light dinner, rice and beans and whatever we could get in fish, or in trade with the villagers, which were few and far between, I can assure you. We had collapsed in our sleeping bags, and that was our pattern month after month. So for 9 months, we were virtually, the two were closer together, but I was alone almost 9 months. It was like three explorers going down the Nile on three separate expeditions.
Wow. Well, you know, I think, folks, what I, you know, have in studying John's adventure and his life and the things that he's done, and he's just recounted here all the different times he encountered danger and whatever, understand what he did and what he accomplished, and it was a huge goal for him, number one, but a huge goal, period. No one in recorded history had ever gone the entire length of the Nile, which is the longest river in the world, 4,200 miles. Stop and think about 4,200 miles, and he did it and his two companions in a little kayak, 15, 16-foot kayak. So, you know, when you've got a big goal, when you've got a huge goal out in front of you, there are going to be some pretty big hippos out there, too, that, you know, are going to present themselves. But in the end, you know, you've got something of phenomenal, phenomenal accomplishment to look back on, and John certainly has in that feat, but many others as well. And John, what I, you know, have asked you before, and I hope you'll explain to the people listening, you know, any number of, you could take one or two of the things you've done. You know, going down the Nile River would be a great life experience. I mean, if that's all someone did in their life, that's a phenomenal, phenomenal, you know, life experience. If you, you know, retrace Marco Polo's steps as you have done, that's a phenomenal experience. Any of the, many of the great adventures that you've done, just if that was the only thing in a person's life that they had done would be a great experience, but you've done 550 plus similar type experiences. And I got to ask you, John, how'd you find time to do all those things?
By developing plans and organizing. You know, I have a little formula that I'd like to share with everyone listening that really works. I hear people all the time say, you know, someday I'm going to do that, or if only I had done that, or I'd really like to do that. And I always say, well, have you set your deadline? Have you started a budget? Have you started planning? Have you pasted that goal on your refrigerator or next to your nightstand and looked at it morning, noon, and night and planned details and reaching that goal? Well, someday I'll do that. I said, someday means you won't do it. Because what you have is a fantasy in your mind, an abstraction of what you'd like to do. But when you are showing sincerity and a serious desire and ambition and drive to do the goal, you write it down and you think about it every day and you gradually flesh out the details so that before too long, you're actually doing the goal. And what a rush, particularly goals that really take a lot of time and money and effort. But, you know, I've seen some of the most incredibly disabled human beings do superhuman things. You remember the story of the blind climber that climbed to the summit of Mount Everest, highest point on Earth at 20,000
feet? Yeah, Eric, I can't like pronounce his last name.
Everyone
said,
that's ridiculous. Most climbers can hardly get halfway up, let alone a blind climber making to the summit. Look at Lance Armstrong, winning all those Grand Prix races, even though he had cancer and he had a sickly childhood. Look at Helen Keller, one of the great human beings of all time, not able to see, hear, or speak, and yet became one of the great inspirations that to this day uplifts people who think they're handicapped and not handicapable like she was. That's my inspiration, seeing other people run marathons when originally they were in a wheelchair, but just said, I'm getting out of this. And look at Superman, Christopher. You know, he was an inspiration throughout because he never gave up. And he reached a point where he was out of the wheelchair, and with electronic help, he was actually taking steps when the doctor said he had never be able to have any activity below the waist.
Well, you know, John, and that leads me to kind of the next area I'd like to explore with you, because, you know, you've encountered death, I think, 42 times, which, you know, I'm sure there were other times that you weren't near death, but there were certainly things that had to have created, you know, some type of fear, and yet, you know, you persisted through that. But I'm really most interested because, I mean, certainly there's the physical threat of fear that we all have, but a bigger fear that kills so many people's dreams and so many people's goals is the fear of rejection and the fear of failure, which I think is bigger than any physical fear because it's such a big dream stealer. How did you, because I mean, a lot of the things that you did were first time things. And you know, there was no one that did it before. So it's not like, you know, you got someone to hang on to. So, well, I know so-and-so did it, so I can do it. You know, you were out there kind of on the point and, you know, you had your more than your share of naysayers. So, I mean, I know you're human. You're a super nice guy, but I know you're human because I met you. And you know, how did you handle the normal human fear of failure and the normal human fear of rejection?
Well, I found at an early age that all successes involve failure. And some of the successes I've had have been through repeated failures and rejection and disappointments and setbacks. But, well, let me give you an example. One of my dreams was to experience a Mach 2 flight in a jet fighter. I learned to fly in the Air Force. I was a flyer for over 2.5 years. And typically, I was turned down from one government agency, Air Force Base Commander, after another. And I learned later that that's automatic, that any civilian that wants to get in a jet fighter or a bomber, unless they're a big celebrity and can be taken up in the traffic pattern, it's just automatic because these planes are being used for combat trainees, men and women who are going into combat with them. Time is of the essence. But I pointed out that through television, I would be able to give an objective plug for our military by giving details of, say, an F-15 or F-16 or a B-1 bomber or B-2, something like that, by experiencing flying and piloting them, and then telling how important it is to keep our military strong, to, you know, have good budgets for our Navy and Marine Corps and Air Force and all the other military organizations that are keeping America strong and helping defend, nations overseas that are under tyranny and dictatorship. And by doing that, I gradually got a better feeling that I would eventually, if I kept persisting, be cleared to go to Nellis Air Force Base near Las Vegas, Nevada, check out in a jet fighter, and I was on my way. And from that point on, I have flown 17 jet fighters and bombers, several of them several times at twice the speed of a 45 caliber bullet. And what a contrast that is to paddling a kayak 20 and 30 miles a day for 9 months. But rejection, we all experience failure and a sense of, at times I felt just so unworthy and, you know, spinning my wheels and wasting time and neglecting other things and feeling, I wake up sometimes and think, my gosh, you really messed up there. That's a human sensation where you're not living up to expectations either from family or friends or yourself and feeling, what have I done that's really been concrete and important? Because I was raised in a Christ-centered home where as an only child, my parents were very doting and could have been so overwhelmingly suffocating or trying to influence me in what I would ultimately become in life. But they were so supportive and so proud of any little thing I achieved, you know, that they gave me the legacy of self-confidence, the feeling I wasn't a flake just because I was non-conventional and, you know, doing things that kids my age were not doing, but making me feel that I was a source of pride to them. My gosh, is that a wonderful thing to a gift to a child? And,
sure,
and growing up with a sense that you could do almost anything if you keep at it and if it's worthwhile and productive. And not just to get your name in the paper. My God, people think I've done all these goals to arouse admiration and get adulation. What nonsense. You do goals because of the inner rewards. They help make you a better person, a better husband, father, professional, wife, mother. You know, just... you're growing, you're expanding, you're not stagnating.
Sure.
We've got stagnant kids that sit and watch TV and watch things they should be out doing. Spectatoritis.
Right. Well, I want to open it up and take a few questions, but before we do, I just want to encourage those on the call. John has a book that he wrote called The Survivor. And I got to tell you, if you enjoyed the little bit you heard tonight, him describing his experience on the Nile, this book, the entire book's that way. And it details a number of his adventures. And it in that detail, it gives you some phenomenal, phenomenal lessons for goal setting, for goal achieving, for pursuing your dreams, for claiming your power. And John has become a master of that. And it is, the book is, you're forced to turn to the next page because you don't know what's going to happen. And it is a great story, and it's true. The wonderful thing is it's got the read of a modern day, you know, novel that thriller, but it's true. And that's what makes it more real and more valuable, at least to me, is the idea that this is true. This is not some creation in a writer's mind. And you can get that book at Amazon, and I'm sure in bookstores, but I got my copy at Amazon.com, and it's called The Survivor. And it's a wonderful, wonderful book. I want to recommend that to you. And we'll take a few questions, and now's a great time to ask that question of a guy who has encountered so many phenomenal challenges in his life, but he's also encountered the very same thing you're encountering tonight, whatever that may be, whether it may be fear or doubt or whatever. And so now's the time to ask him how he handled it so that you can take his example and use it in your own life. Who has a question of John?
Vic, this is Bernie. I just have a comment if I can make it.
Okay.
Okay. You know, I am just totally impressed with John's John, with your personality. The way you came on the call today before Vic came on the call, it just showed an interest in just the way you talked to a couple of us folks. Showed a kind of humility and depth and caring as a caring human being. You know, in addition to being an Olympic adventurer, totally impressive. Well, it's an honor to be on the call with you.
Well, I appreciate that very much. You know, I have a great love for people. And because my folks really live Christianity on a daily basis, what a wonderful thing to grow up with parents that would receive any friend I brought home, whether it was an African-American, Puerto Rican, Mexican, Asian, they had enough confidence in me that they knew that person was a good person. And my folks would make them feel welcome, invite them to dinner, you know, just totally quality. And, you know, when I was a little boy, I felt I was a relative of everyone in the human family. Somehow, if you know, if I sat next to someone at a park, I was talking to an aunt or uncle or cousin or something. When I was a little boy, that the spirit of Jesus so infused in itself that we're all God's children, we're all interrelated people throughout the world, that so invested itself in my mind that whenever I was with pygmies or headhunters, Arabs or Australians or Canadians. I was at home. I was comfortable. And that's a great way to grow up, you know, when you're tailed out, you're a real citizen of the world.
Well, thank you for that. That's one of the things you said tonight.
Who else has a question of John? And before I take the question, let me just that last caller had a phenomenal observation. John is indeed a very humble person. One of the most striking things that I find about him is he is such an accomplished person, but extremely humble. And it's very, very heartening in a day when a lot of the role models, especially for our kids, are not that humble at all. And really, in my opinion, don't cast the right model for people to live by. John is someone who very quietly walks his talk every single day, and that's one of the most striking things that I found about him. So that's a good observation. Who else has a question of John?
Hi, John. This is Deborah. You kind of left us hanging. What happened when you encountered those 32 or 36 people on the bank?
Oh, you mean the pirates?
Yes.
Well, I was all alone, and there were feluccas, these Arab boats, you know, approaching me. And as I got closer, they were the roughest, toughest looking human beings I think I've ever seen. And they were posing, you know, as friendly and jovial and wanting me to come over. And I just had a bad feeling, so I speeded up. And they landed, and two of them got their rifles out and started shooting at me. And fortunately, the river was a little rough. It was a windy day, and there were almost whitecaps. And it kept me dancing up and down in my little fragile cockle shell. But bullets were kicking up spray all around me. But I managed to escape. And then my two partners coming behind me a couple of hours later, they had the same experience. They were accosted, seemingly welcomed, and then when the men just started deviating and getting away from them, they landed and started shooting. And we had a press interview at Cairo. We described that event, and the government official sent out a posse of 200 soldiers. They attacked the mob, they killed some of the leaders, arrested the others. So our attack actually precipitated the capture of these men who had been preying on cargo boats, robbing the crews and taking the cargoes of pottery and grain and things like that.
Fantastic. Who else has a question?
John, it's Chris from New Jersey.
Hi, Chris.
How you doing?
Go ahead, Chris.
How long between the time you set that goal to navigate the Nile to the time you actually did it? And at that time in your life, what effect did it have on the rest of your life, your family and whatever else you were involved in at that time and at that point in your life?
Yes, about the age of 12, that's where I made a serious commitment to do the Nile. And I was 26 when I led the two down the Nile all the way to the Mediterranean. And that was a series of epiphanies. You know, when you're out alone, surrounded by nature, and not involved in the modern world in any degree, even the people along the river were maintaining lifestyles that really haven't changed since the days of Christ and beyond. You know, a lot of their agricultural techniques and all, the shaduf, the sakia, to bring water from the Nile to the fields above, the diet, the clothing, and the non-clothing. Many of the Nile tribes don't wear clothing. It's too hot, and clothing deteriorates too rapidly. But I was immersed in a timeless world where every day there would be some wonderful compensation for the fact I had malaria, schistosomiasis, a serious blood disease. I had a staphylococcus infection and an amoebic dysentery at one time. I even had a tapeworm. Little Rodney, I called him. Well, you have to have a personality when you're with something every minute of every day for months. took 2 years to get rid of Rodney. I kind of missed a little bugger. People say, John, how are you? And I say, we're fine. And they'd say, huh? Silly. There's a spiritual expansion when you're out like that, sleeping under the stars, on the sand, with the heavens displayed above you, and feeling a power, an influence that you'd never experienced before. You know, Dr. David Livingston was one of my heroes, reading about him when I was a kid. Henry Morton Stanley discovered him, quote, in Central Africa. And when Dr. Livingston went back to London for an interview, one of the young journalists said, Dr. Livingston, you have been in Africa for 30 years bringing the gospel to the Africans. How could you endure all that time living under difficult hardships, away from everything familiar, all your family, friends, the comforts of the modern world? And I never forgot the statement that Dr. Livingston gave. He said, well, I'm a follower of Christ, and Jesus promised this more or less vow, lo, I am with thee always. Lo, I am with thee always, to followers of him and living his example. And I never forgot that. I never felt lonely or abandoned or, you know, anything but that comforting spirit all the way down the Nile.
Well, John, I really appreciate it. I know everyone listening tonight as well. You sharing with us, and folks, I just want to tell you, this is just a scratch of the surface of this remarkable individual. And
okay, I just had a quick question for you, actually. Just purchased the book here online from Amazon. And what types of different stories are on it?
Well, the subtitle is 24 Spine-Chilling Adventures on the Edge of Death. You know, during press conferences, I was always asked how many close calls I'd had, and I didn't know, but I had a writer say, please write down what you can remember, and I got up to 42. And I thought I'd write 24 of the most dramatic, life-threatening experiences. But I incorporate in the book the nuts and bolts of goal setting, the problem I had with cancer and overcoming that and fear. And, you know, each story has sort of a lesson I learned from experiencing. And all the profits from the book go to a dozen different environmental groups. That's been my pleasure to contribute to, you know, wonderful groups dedicated to protecting our natural resources, wildlife and wetlands and forests and all.
Okay, very interesting. I am getting ready to head to law school and down in Mississippi.
Where will you be going?
I will be going to Mississippi College School of Law.
Wonderful.
Down in Jackson, and very much looking forward to it.
I hope you become a good environmental lawyer.
You know, I've thought about it, actually.
Oh.
It's definitely been a thought, and I have a lot of people that are doing that. I'm still keeping with the theme of doing a lot of my goal setting, you know, all throughout law school, even though I'm going to be, you know, swamped and all of that. And just kind of wondering how you were able to, manage both your personal life and your goals at the same time, or how did you mix the two together?
Well, family always came first. I have five wonderful children, and I've always, you know, allotted time to be with them, quality time. We do things together. I've taken them to Africa and South America. We've gone skin diving and hiking and rock climbing and things. But
wow.
It's budgeting your time. And, you know, I wish every American home would be have television unavailable. It's just the worst addiction imaginable, with the average home watching 6 and 7 hours a day. Think what you could do with that 6 and 7 hours if you read more and expanded your vision and your goals.
I agree with you.
Well, that's
there
great. There are a lot of good, worthwhile things on TV. I don't put it down totally. It's just that people just use it too much.
Well, I tend to watch CNN or MSNBC or something like that while I'm having a quick bite to eat for lunch. Maybe a little bit of a news brief there.
Well, good luck to you. And I hope you'll seriously think of that, because we need quality folk in protecting from the politicians in power who don't give a hang about protection. They only think about exploitation and profit.
I do appreciate it, John.
You bet.
Okay, bye-bye.
Best of luck.
Thank you.
You have a question, ma'am?
Yes, and I'm Don Paul from Paris.
From Paris?
Yes.
Wonderful. I love Paris.
Yeah, it's a beautiful city.
My two French partners were two of the finest and bravest men I've ever known.
That's nice.
Did you hear of Jean Laporte in the past?
Yep.
He was quite famous in Europe.
Yes, he was.
From the Nile expedition.
My question was, have you ever been in a situation where you're going after a goal and you're nearing completion, and suddenly you have the opportunity to do another goal, but following through the second goal would mean you have to drop your first goal? In that situation, what kind of questions would you ask yourself to choose among those two goals? If you have to drop the first one?
Well, hon, I've done over 500 goals, and on 1 3-month expedition, I checked off and realized 30 different goals. You don't have to cross out a goal. Sometimes you have to postpone it or hold it in abeyance, you know, hold it back until you do goals that are more immediate. It's a matter of time and money. A lot of goals cost a lot of money, and I've just had to save and save and, you know, just work it out.
Okay.
Bon chance.
So just keep the goal on the list and just postpone it for later.
Yeah, you can you use your priorities. The goals that you can do, I have immediate goals, medium-term goals, long-term goals. And sometimes you'll do one goal and it makes you think of several others in the area, in the field, you know.
Yeah.
And you just have a lifetime of achievement that way, where you wake up every morning with things to do above and beyond just the ordinary. And that's what makes life really exciting and adventurous. But
yeah.
Best of luck to you. Well, it was a pleasure talking to you all.
Yes.
Good
pleasure
luck to
hearing
you.
From you. Thank you very much for your
thank
time.
Thank you, John.
So what I'm going to do is, John, thank you very much from the bottom of my heart. Lisa says a big hello to you.
You're a great interviewer.
And
always one of the best, if not the best.